Today is Wednesday. It's January 19th, 2022, and it is 2:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and you're listening to the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Hey, it's John Hanson of Block Club Chicago at WGN Radio.
This is Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
This is Eric Zorn, the indignant publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, an occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
Do you guys want to ask him or should I?
Indignant about what?
Thank you. Thank you, Austin. Thank you. Well done.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is like that Johnny Carson
retreat.
It really is. It was very hot today. How hot was it? I'm indignant that Jason Van Dyke is getting out of prison so soon after he was sentenced just 3 years ago. And we'll talk about that later. But I will try to control my indignation as we talk about other subjects.
Well, be as indignant as you feel is necessary. Are you indignant about the rollout of the free COVID tests? How optimistic are you that the United States government and the United States Postal Service will get it right? Okay, that's Eric's thought. John Hanson, go.
I signed up yesterday on beta day. It was super easy. We'll wait to see if I get it, but I was blown away at how easy it was, and I think it's going to go great.
I don't know how to read that, but I was optimistic about and still am how easy it was to do. They wordled it. They just said, hey, give us your name. You play once, you're good to go. Austin, what do you think?
Yeah, track record would suggest that it's not going to be good, but I think this is fantastic. I wish it was done 18 months ago. It's fabulous. Other countries like Germany has always been really quick and easy to get rapid tests for more than a year now. The United States has been really dragging behind. Tests are really expensive, still sometimes hard to find them. So I could not think of a better use of tax money than doing this. And I wish it was done sooner.
What a failure of two administrations to get this done. I mean, really bad. And I'm sometimes a big Biden defender, but this was nonsensical. This was a promise from the get-go. And I know it's hard to move mountains to do these sorts of things, but for someone that harped on the Defense Production Act for so long, I mean, in some countries, you get a little pack, you get chicken noodle soup delivered to you, you get a test, you get maybe a little NyQuil or something. They make them in these, like, packages.
Care packages.
How could we not have done this?
Well, then you're getting four tests per address, right? Which if you've got like two people in your house, that's good. If you've got five kids or something like that, it's not going to be enough. I think if this were a regular program, if this were something that was coming out every couple of weeks, I would have more optimism for it. If the Postal Service worked better, I would have more optimism for it. But seriously, I think that what we're going to see with the Omicron variation is that it is probably going to burn itself out before these tests get here.
Yes.
And that, I mean, I'm generally fairly optimistic long-term about this. I'm not sure that this testing thing is going to make that much difference, but
why do you say that? I mean, a test is a test. You take it before you go to grandma's. What's the problem with that?
I don't think it's a problem with it. I just don't think it's going to be part of the major solution here. I think that the solution itself is just in time and good fortune, probably. And the vaccines. I mean, I would much rather they went door to door giving vaccines.
Oh, boy.
You and your silly vaccines.
Is this Germany, Eric?
I'm a free man. You can't do that. And by the way, the people that are going to get vaccinated are vaccinated. The people who aren't going to get vaccinated aren't get vaccinated.
Isn't Trump saying that white people can't get vaccinated now? I guess what he was saying.
You know, I haven't read a word he has written, and I haven't repeated a word he has said since Twitter turned him off. I think that's almost 100% true statement. My blood pressure has gone down 18.3%. I mean, really, that remains to be one of the best things social media has done in the last ever.
Yeah, I'm very happy that when he's out on social media, but he does get a lot of airtime on Fox and OAN. And he gets
OAN.
People are retweeting him all the time. So I saw that. I mean, but they retweet him to mock him. So I saw that excerpt from his yeah. speech the other night where he said that white people are being put at the back of the line and discriminated against by the left. The left is doing this. So I don't know how he got a secret memo, but he did.
I think Democrats do better when he tweets. I will say that he's a big enemy when he's able to say whatever the heck he wants to everybody. And
he's an enemy to Republicans.
No, I think he's a Democrat. I think he's a really easily rally upon figure for Democrats to see this boogeyman when he's more omnipresent than just not on social media as much.
Well, I want to make sure I got you right, John, because it would seem to me like if Donald Trump is out there, say he's a force in the dialogue again, does that benefit Democrats more because they can rally against it, or Republicans because they can rally around it?
Democrats.
We talked about this a little bit in Virginia. There are definitely a lot of instances, and I think it will be interesting to see what happens in the midterms, where Trump not having a massive online platform benefited Republicans running statewide in certain races because they don't have to contend with his comments and they don't really have to worry about him coming out and making himself federalizing these sort of state races. And I think that's not the biggest reason that Glenn Youngkin won, but I think you'd be hard pressed to argue that Donald Trump not being on Twitter hurt Youngkin. I think it helped him.
They worked pretty hard to keep Trump out of Virginia, didn't they?
They did. So he had an interesting strategy, which was reportedly he was constantly speaking with Trump, but would not say anything really publicly about him, and Trump wouldn't really say anything about him publicly back. So he sort of placated him, I guess, in a way.
Okay, don't come next Thursday. I've got a thing on Thursday afternoon. Let my scheduling people get back to you.
Yeah. Well, notice what's happened since Virginia and a near win in New Jersey. Now President Trump's saying, hey, every candidate should say that they got the booster. There is this strange pivot that we are now seeing from the former president and almost making Governor DeSantis and other folks seem further right than him. I think he reads numbers and reads independents somewhat well. I don't know. We've been saying he was going to pivot forever. I'm kind of sick of talking about him too, but maybe he's learned a thing or two.
Well, what was the thing I saw on CNN, and my speaker was muted. I was on the air at the time, but it seemed like there was a montage of candidates in Arizona running, each of them repeating Trump's take on the election results. John, do you know what I'm talking about?
It was from when he visited Arizona, I would imagine. Yeah.
The headline was that they are all continuing to carry the bucket for him on the big lie. That's still a resonant talking point for conservatives in Arizona.
I think this is what conservatives mean when they say that he lives rent free in people's heads, that we one mention of him and we tangentially went off on a Trump rant.
Yeah, this was us not talking about him. Let's segue now to our campaign 2022 segment. Who will the next governor of Illinois be? I doubt it will be Radio Shock Jock Mankow. Darren Bailey, I don't think will get votes in Chicagoland. Will it be the mayor of Aurora? And if you were a billionaire, would you bet millions of your dollars on him? Citadel founder Ken Griffin says he'll finance the campaign of anyone who can beat J.B. Pritzker. I'm starting to wonder if he'll finance the campaign of anyone who can annoy J.B. Pritzker. Richard Irvin, Aurora's mayor, that's the second largest city in Illinois, has an impressive resume for a Democrat. So why is he running as a Republican, and does he win?
I still think Governor Pritzker is in the captain's seat here leading the way. I know we've had a Republican governor in Illinois not all that long ago, but I feel like when you break down Governor Pritzker's polling, he is still above water on many, many things, including his handling of the pandemic, Illinois' economy. He's already running these ads that are targeting his effectiveness of the economy, that the bond rating from other folks went up for the first time since the 80s. And I think that is working with people. Now, Illinois was a plus 17 blue state for Biden over Trump, which is a lot. But we've seen gaps larger than that fall in an off-year election. So I'm not saying it's a slam dunk, but it's pretty close for me.
Joining us now on the Mincing Rascals is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV in Springfield, Mark Maxwell, who's a well-known voice and byline in Illinois on state politics. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. Great to be with you guys.
What is the read on Richard Irvin's candidacy for governor? He has a lot of marks against him as a Republican.
Well, he also has a lot of, he checks a lot of boxes for Republicans, especially in places like the suburbs. When you look back at 2020, some Republican operatives would look at the congressional races for Congress there, and they would bring from that some clues as to what voters are looking for as they elect the next generation of Republicans. There were three categories that performed really well. They were candidates of color, they were combat veterans, or they were women. And he checks two of those boxes for starters. You also look at the other issues of the race, and Republicans are clearly trying to make the fight against crime one of their big messages. He was a prosecutor, and you saw his campaign rollout video where he said he went up door to door with police as a community prosecutor to knock on doors in drug raids. He puts himself right there in the middle of that fight to try and suggest that he has firsthand experience doing this. That's a strong message, a strong story that I think Republicans will look to and say, this is someone who, in addition to, you know, being a candidate to become the first black governor in the land of Lincoln, it also scratches that itch that Republicans have had for a while, I think, to answer the charge that they were behind on social justice issues, or, you know, that's another strong component in this upcoming election.
When you look at crime, he was able to invoke in his speech, he said, all lives matter, which was, of course, is kind of a dig at Black Lives Matter. And he talked about at some point being able to fire prosecutors. He was going to fire liberal prosecutors, and he was opposed to defund the police, which I've always said was a pretty dumb slogan for anyone to be advancing, but it's now being thrown back in Democrats' faces. But realistically, how much role does a governor have in fighting crime in the streets of Chicago, the streets of Aurora, the places where people are concerned about it?
Right. I mean, that's definitely going to be parsed through. The one example was in the aftermath to the killing of George Floyd with the protests and the riots. We saw Ken Griffin, the richest man in the state and a GOP mega donor, allude to that. He says he wants to see a governor take more action to call in the National Guard. And that's an action a governor can take. Governor Pritzker did on June 1st call in the National Guard to 9 counties at first, and then added a few other counties later. And then it was the cities and the mayors who sort of put the rules of engagement in place to say what these National Guard troops could do in assisting their local police forces and what they couldn't. So there is some handoff there, but really most prosecutors answer to the Illinois Attorney General and to the voters of their county. So there's not a direct authority that I'm aware of, and maybe others can chime in on that, but I don't think a governor can just fire a prosecutor. That's not how that works.
And it's a great message. Like, I'm really concerned about crime, and I think a lot of us are concerned about crime, but as governor, what can you do about it? You've got to rely on mayors, on prosecutors, on sheriffs, on superintendents of police, and so
on. Well, he doesn't have to prove that he's going to do anything about it. He's just got to talk about it enough, right? He's got to just make that the issue.
But the other, so I think Mark's totally right. Like, his personal story is super compelling. Grew up in Section 8 housing, successful legal career, served his country in the military. But he also has this this record as mayor that is going to be brought up a lot in the Republican primary. And I think those will be his biggest hurdles. And one of those, I think, is on the issue of public safety. So, I mean, you guys are all from Illinois. Like, Aurora as a city is not seen as a bastion of public safety necessarily, especially in the suburbs and places like DuPage County. And we actually saw some really intense looting and rioting in Aurora last summer with some really harrowing footage of that. Shootings, I think, were up 40%. So it's going to be, I think, tough potentially in the primary for Irvin to say, you know, public safety, I'm the public safety candidate. I'm sure there will be Republican primary opponents saying, well, look at Aurora. That wasn't very safe. He didn't do such a great job there. Why would you believe him here? So that potentially one line of attack that he may have to deal with.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I noticed in his rollout, he said Aurora is now safe. It's a safe city. The gauntlet's been dropped.
The 90s, 100%. Like, the Aurora of today is totally different than the 90s, but it would be, I think, incorrect to say it didn't see a really large spike in crime over the pandemic, as many cities did. but including Aurora.
Talking about a Republican against a fairly popular, or at least somewhat popular, governor, Democratic governor in a blue state. Mark, I'm just curious what you think about it being, obviously, our gubernatorial elections are in these off-year elections, and you have the House of Representatives in play, obviously, for Republicans. You're talking about suburban districts. You're going to have tight races in the Underwood district, in the, you know, in the sixth as well. I mean, those races could help buoy a potentially Republican candidate for governor, too, right?
Well, that's all going to play. And you mentioned the suburbs, too. That's another interesting point. You know, when 60 Republicans came out on Urban's second day of his campaign and they all backed Richard Urban for governor, a lot of them were from the suburbs. There was one interesting name not on that list. House Republican leader Jim Durkin was on it, but Senate Republican leader Dan McConkey was not. I talked to him yesterday and said, why wasn't your name on that list? All these establishment Republicans are lining up to back Urban. And he wouldn't quite go there yet. I think he wants to still feel the candidate out and get some feels, a better sense for who he is. But he did make the point, this is Minority Leader Dan McConkey, that he's the only candidate from the suburbs, and that does give him a leg up in what pretty much every Republican sees as the key battlefield to winning a statewide election in 2022. So I think you're right. There are some suburban, you know, congressional politics and federal politics. You know, do the suburbs like or distrust a Joe Biden administration? And to what extent does that, you know, political pendulum swinging back toward the middle possibly make Democrats a bit vulnerable in the suburbs? Can Urban capitalize on that effect alone? We heard the last Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, really kind of blame the national political wins for his own downfall. And I think there is some element of that in these off years in the midterms when, you know, a lot of American voters look to correct course.
Is Ken Griffin going to finance his campaign, and to what tune?
There's no doubt. You don't, the entire slate of these candidates that are now officially calling themselves a slate, right, which is sort of a vulgar word in Republican Party politics. They're all lining up. They're using the same campaign operations and a lot of the same staff. Any well-sourced reporter who is, or, you know, talk to any of these operatives who are lining up. I mean, it's very obvious that you don't just jump into a race like this unless you know you're going to have pretty big financial backing. And the campaign operatives who are lining up these races are the very same people who ran the campaign for Bruce Rauner and who have a direct line to Ken Griffin and his political thought.
Is Darren Bailey's campaign, it seems to me like he's the one who is the main competitor from the far right right now. I looking just at the financing and the publicity that he gets and so on. And he's certainly going to make a huge issue out of Urban having pulled Democratic ballots. There's that video that the Pritzker campaign has been shopping around that shows Urban on stage and Aurora praising Pritzker's response to the pandemic and like, I think embracing him almost, or, you know, putting an arm around him. And is that kind of just really relentless moderate position going to poison things so much for Urban with the far right of the party, which seems to be kind of in control these days? I mean, is that how you see this race shaping up? Is it sort of going to be a Bailey Urban contest, or do you think Sullivan is, or I mean, Rabine and Shrimp seem to be far back right now. What's your read on that?
Well, first of all, that's just such an incredible commentary on where we are in our American politics. Wasn't it Abraham Lincoln who said, "Haven't I rid myself of an enemy if I make them my friend?" Is it the most ultimate betrayal if you say a nice thing about somebody in the other party? I maybe it will be in a primary. We'll see. But to answer your question more directly, look, I always caution people not to underestimate Darren Bailey because of the fervent passion of his base, right? I think he's the only candidate in this race right now who has an actual base of voters. You see this in social media. You see this in a lot, but you also don't want to overestimate that, right? I mean, is that the average voter, or does the average voter only tune in like 2 weeks before the election? So when you look into the campaign behavior and the finance reports, I think there is actually some really big red flags that pop out from the Darren Bailey campaign. Gary Rabine, who's kind of flown under the radar, actually outraised him in the fourth quarter of this last year. That's a problem for Darren Bailey. It's also a problem for Darren Bailey that he spent, I think, $200,000 to $300,000 more than he raised in that same fourth quarter. We're 5-6 months from the primary, and you're already going through a burn rate that high where you're just spending your cash faster than you're bringing it in. The third red flag you see is that in quarter three of last year, Bailey outraised himself in quarter four. So his contributions are trending downward. Is that an early sign that maybe he's already tapped into, you know, he's already reached his ceiling? I don't know. Again, maybe he'll start getting more fundraising success later on. But it certainly looks like his campaign has some warning signs on it.
Mark, I didn't look at these, Mark. Does Sullivan still have the most money of all of them?
Well, so far, right. I mean, Sullivan has, I think, $9 million cash on hand. But Sullivan's problem, there's been this longstanding divide in the Republican Party between the establishment and the far right, right? And right now, that's the Trump right. Sullivan is really having a hard time finding allegiances. And he has put in, he's pounded the pavement. He went and kissed the ring of former Governor Edgar. And he's been talking to all these local party officials across the state, trying to get some favor. But we're hearing that he's having a hard time getting a running mate. And as you know, you can't pass petitions to get those signatures to get on the ballot until you have a running mate. Now, maybe they'll announce someone soon, but we're aware that he's approached several different parties trying to find that perfect pairing, and he's come up empty. So Sullivan's got the cash. Rabine's got a little bit of cash, and he's got the ability to raise and self-fund. Bailey's got the base, so we're going to see how Griffin shakes this up. To say Irvin. Sorry, that was a Freudian slip.
I was remembering Jeannie Ives, who gave Rauner a real run for his money back in 2016, I think it was. I'm trying to remember, or 2018. 18. When was it? 18. Who, of course, and Ives checked some of the boxes that Mark talked about. She was a veteran and a woman, and I'm just thinking that Bailey with the same will be going for that same vote. And Ives put a real scare into Rauner, as I recall. It was a very close primary. I mean, given that Rauner was the incumbent and everything. So I'm interested to see how the electorate shakes out. And I'm also interested in Irvin's choice of running mate, who is Avery Bourne, right, who is a young, very conservative state legislator, right? She's considered by some people to be the future of the Illinois Republican Party. Is that a wise choice? Is that going to be the kind of candidate who's going to draw those voters that he's going to need to sort of thread the needle here?
There's that old line that a running mate will never win you an election, but they can lose you one, right? There can be a downside. Avery Bourne has the least downside to lose Richard Irvin an election here. The other thing she offers, which is an important piece for Richard Irvin, who is a stranger to most downstate Republicans, is that Avery Bourne is perhaps the most well-liked downstate Republican among establishment county level Republican elected officials or just the precinct committeemen. What she offers Richard Irvin is that introduction. She can say, hey, I'm with him, he's with me, and there's that sense of calm, right? If there were any uneasy stomachs downstate that said, I don't know, this guy, he's from the suburbs, he's not like us, Avery Bourne is going to smooth that over. So does that really help the turnout? Not necessarily, but it might help get some important door knockers and field organizers into the Irvin camp.
Before we let you go, Mark, how much money is going to be spent by Ken Griffin and how much of J.B. Pritzker's money is going to be spent in this next race?
Well, J.B. Pritzker, I think, and you guys can check me on this, I think his $90 million check to his campaign fund is the single largest political contribution in Illinois state history. And possibly, I haven't checked the federal side, but maybe in any statewide race, he's basically upping the ante saying, if you want to take me out, you're going to have to double down and you're going to have to bring all the money you got. It's kind of a gross commentary on where we're at, that a lot of times we just look at the big pile of money, and I think a lot of voters and maybe even some reporters just kind of, you know, say, well, I guess that's it. how are you going to compete? But on the Republican side, I mean, we've seen some reports that Ken Griffin has pledged to spend up to $300 million, which would be a pretty big pile of cash. I don't know if he plans to use that all on the governor's race or if he wants to spread that across the other slate of candidates who are running for Secretary of State or Treasurer. I suppose we'll wait and see. I was not able to confirm that dollar amount. I think Marianne Ahern with NBC5 had that scoop. But look, this is going to be possibly setting another national record at how much, how many campaign contributions will be coming in to, you know, really influence the shape of and the direction of Illinois' elected leaders.
Well, the job does not pay more than $100 million a year, right? There's something offensive to me about spending $90 million for a job that pays about $200,000. I know that's a stupid comparison, but at some point, does the money ever get to be offensive to people? We're like all pawns out here just to be purchased up by these billionaires.
Well, I don't know that the money offends people so much as just the barrage of TV commercials. I'm already sick of Pritzker's commercials. I mean, it's February or not. It's not even February. It's still January. And I think by the time that we roll around to this election, people, I don't know that $90 million is really going to, at some point, you're just irritating people, aren't you?
Unlike, say, going to the moon or something where you can almost spend an unlimited amount of cash, there's like an actual saturation point with ads. There's a limited supply. You can only do so much. I remember one of my favorite moments of the progressive tax fight was when the ballot committee funded by Pritzker was spending money on fair tax ads on Facebook in California because like there just wasn't like there's not enough.
There's only one Facebook.
Yeah, like they're in California. So I agree with Eric that there's this like the marginal returns after, say, 50, 70 million. Like how much are you really getting from that extra million? Maybe it's people in the field. Maybe it's boots on the ground and not ad money. But I tend to agree with you, Eric.
JB and Ken Griffin spent a total of over $110 million of their own personal monies on that fight alone, which, again, I just think means we're all out there to be purchased up, even if there is diminishing returns. I must be the only one offended by that number.
Before Mark goes, I want to know if you have a take on any of these other statewide races, the Secretary of State's races.
I think we're in for an ugly turn in the Democratic primary for Secretary of State, which is really where the only Democratic primary action is right now. But I think Crane Chicago Business has reported some about City Clerk Anna Valencia blocking the release of some emails that include her husband's name. Her husband is a lobbyist who has some clients, and those clients' names were listed in those emails. It looks like the Janulius camp is ramping up to try to drag down her poll numbers. She's been making the case that, hey, when voters hear all of the rosy things about me and my backstory, my story sells. Of course, that's not how campaigns work. You got to put up with the mudslinging too. So if you're looking for, I don't know if people get excited by mudslinging in politics anymore, but that's probably where the next smoke will start on the Democratic side. And the Republican side, it's really all the governor's race. The only real competition there on the Secretary of State is Dan Brady, who was already in the race. It's a little bit of a surprise that he didn't get the establishment backing. He's very well connected in the establishment circles, and he was running for Secretary of State and apparently wasn't the candidate that the Griffin folks wanted to put their money behind. So those are probably, if we're handicapping those races, the other thing to look for, and this is a congressional race, but Nikki Budzinski is probably not going to sail to just winning the 13th congressional seat vacated by Rodney Davis as he shifts over into a new district. She's not going to probably just coast. There's going to be a Republican effort to try and beat her. And it's really going to be interesting to see which candidate throws their hat into the ring there.
We'll leave it at that, Mark. Thanks for joining us. That's Mark Maxwell, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. Mark, it's a pleasure. You guest with us many times on WGN Radio. We see you elsewhere. Thanks for helping us out today on The Mincing Rascals.
You bet, John. Thanks.
So he's going to ruin things for us because he knows what he's talking about, John.
A lot. A real problem. I do think sort of this Sullivan, Irvin, Bailey have very different pathways to victory in a primary. So Irvin, I think, will mightily struggle downstate because of his remarks about Pritzker. The Democratic Governors Association came out with a video of like a supercut of Richard Irvin publicly praising the governor, who is not popular among Republican primary voters in downstate Illinois.
Really?
I think that's going to be really, yeah.
Oh, he was at the top of the list.
Like even though his lieutenant governor choice is a downstate Republican, that is people seeing that on television, seeing him introducing Pritzker as a good friend and a great leader, I think it's going to be really tough to overcome. Meanwhile, I think Darren Bailey doesn't relate to suburban Republican primary voters. Darren Bailey is a lot more like my uncles outside of Effingham than, you know, your average Gen X and boomer moms and dads in the suburbs of DuPage County or Lake County. And Sullivan, I think his path to victory would be he has very solutions oriented, positive, optimistic candidate, also pro-life. So can he shave off enough suburban vote and downstate vote from those two to have a path to victory, which I think would be interesting because he has money to spend and it is a pretty likable candidate, I would say.
I think you're putting the point on that the Republican Party as a whole is going to face in all of these primaries moving forward, right? As many Dems and disarray stories as there are and can be, Republican primary voters are not always going to pick the candidate that has the best chance to beat Democratic candidates. And that is because of the wider division in the Republican Party now than probably there's ever been before. That's going to be huge. I mean, that's going to the primaries here are going to really shape just how big of a gap the Republicans are going to be able to take into Democrats in the House and other races, too.
For those of you keeping score at home, Jason Van Dyke could be out of jail in a few weeks. Jailed for 81 months for shooting black teenager Laquan McDonald. Van Dyke is scheduled to be released in half that time due to his, as Eric Zorn says, quote unquote, good behavior. We haven't had to think about this for a while, but now the topic seems fresh, doesn't it? Was Van Dyke's sentence long enough, Eric?
It was not long enough, and it was, I think, the sentencing itself is somewhat scandalous. The judge, Vincent Gaughan, decided he was going to sentence Van Dyke on the lesser charge that he was convicted of, which was second-degree murder, because the aggravated battery with a firearm charges, which carry longer sentences, he thought didn't adequately describe the crime. Now, the problem with that is that it turns out that because second-degree murder is such a fuzzy crime in some ways, very covers a lot of different circumstances, the sentencing guidelines are lower than it is for aggravated battery with a firearm. And Gaughan said, well, that makes no sense. You could shoot somebody in the little finger and get a longer sentence than you could. Well, anyway, this is something that the Illinois Supreme Court has actually wrestled with in a 2004 case. And they came back and they said, no, you have to sentence someone on the most serious crime that they're convicted of. So Attorney General Kwame Raoul goes to the Illinois Supreme Court and says, you know, hey, we want this sent back. We want this sentencing redone. And the Illinois Supreme Court, three Republicans plus Justice Ann Burke on the Illinois Supreme Court said no. They just turned them down. The other justices two other justices that participated were pretty vehement, saying that this is contrary to law and contrary to precedent, and that Gaughan relied on a dissent in that old case, and the thing should be sent back. So Van Dyke should still be in prison. I think there's very little question about that. I mean, by law, he's going to walk out in 2 weeks from Thursday, but he's going to get hit. The sentence that he got for what he did was preposterously light. And I understand why the activists are having a protest plan. They want to shut down the CTA for 16 days, which I hope they don't do, because I feel like shutting down the CTA is only going to hurt marginalized communities. The people who rely on public transportation to get to and from work tend to be working class people. So that shutting down their access to their jobs and to their doctors and so on, it seems very counterproductive. They're also asking the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, Lausch, to look at this case again and perhaps file civil rights charges against Van Dyke. That you can, it's like another bite at the apple, a form of double jeopardy that's not technically double jeopardy. He was convicted on state charges in Cook County Court. They want him to be tried for violating Laquan McDonald's civil rights in federal court, which again could carry a substantial penalty. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I certainly understand why all those activists are angry about this.
It doesn't help that time has been completely warped. I think also it seems like I saw a really good post on Twitter that had a timeline, and it was 2010 to 2014 nostalgia, 2015 to 2020, 2016. That's what that was labeled. And then 2020 to 2022 pandemic. I feel like that the Van Dyke stuff feels it's crazy to me that it's only been.
Yeah, it seems so long ago. I'd say, yeah, he was in jail for a long time and justice was served. Yeah. But if you remind me that wasn't 4 years, I'm like, how did I not remember that? How am I not appreciating that until Eric brought it up or until it's got a little traction in the news? February 3rd. Is it February 3rd? Is that his release date?
Yes, February 3rd.
Saw that headline and thought, wait a minute. I don't know that shutting down public transportation is a good idea, but if you want to get attention, that always that always works. That always
sure
gets
does.
People's attention. Here's nothing. Shut down the Dan Ryan. Just string bodies across there, and that'll piss people off to no end. And then what? I don't know that that does anything to your cause, but the cause is, in this case, just get attention to the fact.
Well, again, they're asking Lausch, to the U.S. attorney, to prosecute Van Dyke on these civil rights charges.
That's a dangerous precedent, though, to do it this much later after the fact. It's like the Chauvin thing, right? They're going to try him for similar things, even though he's already been convicted. But they're doing it soon, the federal...
The example that I always think of is the Rodney King case. If you remember, the police officers who were charged in Rodney King were acquitted in Simi Valley by, I guess, an all-white jury. And so they then were able to convict them on civil rights. I mean, and their acquittal was what touched off the riots in Los Angeles. And then they were able to prosecute them through the federal system and see some justice served, which strikes me in retrospect as being a fair thing to do. Here, the fact that he's already been tried and convicted, and he has spent time in prison, as much as I think he should spend more time in prison, I'm very uneasy with this use of this federal-state bifurcation to essentially bring the same charges against the same person for the same act.
It feels like double jeopardy, doesn't it?
It feels like it. I know it's technically not, but it really does feel like it. And we should be uneasy about that, and we should only use it in cases where we think that, say, the county trial was just a sham, and I don't think that it was. I think the judge made the wrong call, but I don't think the trial itself was a sham. So, I would have a hard time getting behind that idea because it seems like it's a bad precedent.
Speaking of all of this, I have a paragraph written here that I'm not real that I don't love, but I'm going to read it to you guys and tell me if there's something to talk about here. Speaking of that, Eric. How does the panel feel about former Mayor Rahm Emanuel's role in the shooting and the cover-up of Laquan McDonald? Austin, you've spoken on this podcast vehemently and eloquently about Rahm's role and the $5 million the city paid to Laquan McDonald's family even before the lawsuit against the city was filed, a payment made just after the mayor's reelection, too. Joe Ferguson, the ousted city watchdog, wrote a letter to U.S. senators vouching for Rahm Emanuel, saying there was no evidence that Emanuel covered up the story. Lori Lightfoot today is aghast at that. Vouching for Rahm's appointment as Japan's ambassador, Lori Lightfoot says, why would you exonerate him for the McDonald shooting?
So a letter from Joe Ferguson is about the only thing that could change my mind about what happened and Rahm Emanuel's involvement in that. His work as inspector general was second to none, really trusted public official, probably the most competent public official in the state of Illinois for the last 20 years is Joe Ferguson. And that's what he wrote. He said that he did not find evidence that Rahm Emanuel was I even think he extended that to his legal team, you know, was personally involved in quote unquote, sort of covering this up. And the mayor, This letter was before the new year, I believe. I think this was in December when he submitted this to the Senate, this panel. So the timing of the mayor being weeks later
after the confirmation,
the media, say again, John?
After the confirmation.
Right. Yeah. After the confirmation to take a shot at Ferguson because he was critical of some of her administration's actions, as he should be as inspector general, seemed extremely petty to me. And I think Lightfoot maybe trying to save face and maybe to show the media to get another shot at this guy. So stop listening to what he says. So, it was really surprising to me to see that. And now my opinion, I think, is a lot more mixed about what happened because Ferguson, more than anyone else, knows those cases and has done that work.
So you're persuaded, maybe, by you.
Yeah, there's certainly questions about the timing still, and it's just, it lines up too well for the mayor. For them not, this is a political town.
Yeah.
Someone talked to someone. Like, you just it has to be true. I'm crazy if that's, we're all crazy if that's not true. Like, this, the mayor had an interest in keeping that quiet before the election, but Joe Ferguson didn't find any evidence of that.
Can I also just point out that when Emanuel was nominated, Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, quote, "I wish him every success in his further service to our country." And here it is. Now that she has the cover of the nomination already gone through to take a stand against that.
I'm sorry, John, what's your point about that?
It's so feckless. Have a principle and stick with it.
You're totally right, John, because then, so if she thinks Ferguson is lying, she thinks this guy covered up a murder.
Yes.
So why are you out saying that he's served his country and I wish him all the best?
And Lori certainly needs more feck. That's for sure.
Boy, now, is she a scorekeeper or what? She does not let any insult go unnoticed, does she? Any slight?
She doesn't give a feck.
My take on this thing has been that Emanuel, I don't believe he covered it up. I think he just took advantage of the fact that the procedures that were in place, and Ferguson says this in his letter, that Emanuel followed the procedures that had long been in place about what to do with evidence like this and how to release videos and stuff. He did not proactively by any means try to get this story out, and he certainly could have. I mean, those were conventions that were in behavior in the city in terms of when we release information and how we say we're not going to release information and so on. So was it an active cover-up or was it more of a passive cover-up? And I still don't understand why no one in his political shop thought, when this happened, like, we got to get out in front of this and say, and we have to demand answers. We've got to be the one out in front of the march saying, we want answers here. I don't think that he would have paid a political price for that. I don't think that he would have lost the election or anything if he had been saying that he was very concerned about this and he wanted the information out as quickly as possible. I guess somebody must have disagreed, but I've never understood the argument that he had to have it covered up in order to win that election.
Mayor Lightfoot did a terrible job with the Anjanette Young raid. And while that was under a different administration, the leaked emails from CBS showing how little effort was made to make that information public and out there. Ugh.
Yeah. And Anjanette Young lived, of course.
And of course. Did. I mean, they're way different circumstances, but to get on this high horse as if she is the model of transparency when she is anything but is ridiculous.
Well, what about the exotic car dealership on Rush Street that Joe Perillo owns? I'm not exactly sure what happened there, but some city inspectors showed up and they said, oh, we have all sorts of COVID violations here. Oh, and you have booze in that cabinet, so we're going to write a ticket for that. And you're not
cooperating. Who would have thought an exotic car dealership would have a couple bottles? You know, we should definitely sniff that out. That's a really high priority.
And all of this on the heels of somebody broke into the Perillo dealership. They took hammers and smashed into where some exotic watches were being kept, and they stole millions of dollars of watches. Perillo then is outraged at the city's handling of these sorts of crimes. Mayor Lightfoot shows up. They get into a conversation that gets very heated. She probably calls him an idiot or a moron. And then she walks off and nothing productive has happened. He says, well, I didn't hear her say that. Did she say that? And I'm thinking, I wasn't there either. And yes, she did. So she walks off. And now, a few days later, what a coincidence, this petty little inspector, which the mayor's office said had nothing to do with the previous conversation the two of them had. It was just a coincidence that they showed up. I would have had more respect for Lori Lightfoot if she said, yeah, I was pissed, so I sent my dogs out. We got it done.
Do we have a theme song for campaign 2023 yet? We have to get on that. But I think, did you see Paul Vallis had an op-ed in the Tribune? I think it was Monday, maybe Tuesday, about all his strategies for fighting crime. And there's no way that Paul Vallis, he says he's not going to run for mayor, but there's no way he's not running for mayor. You see op-eds by him. You see op-eds by Arne Duncan, both of them saying they know how to solve the crime problem. I agree with what Mark said earlier, which is that crime is going to be, I think, a major issue in the 2022 race, but probably also the issue in the mayor's race in 2023.
Well, and I agree with John Hansen that nobody knows how to solve the crime problem. You just need to convince people that you know how to solve the crime problem. We all know how to solve the crime problem. Get people educated, have better nuclear families, diversify the economy so that it's spread throughout the city. That's how you solve the crime problem. And nobody can do that. You can't just become governor and do that. But if you can persuade people that you're tough on crime, then you can get elected. I mean, that's how intractable I think that situation is.
What I would love is a Republican candidate, and maybe we'll see it. It's still early in the primary. Just put out the most boring white paper, 10 pages. Here's all the laws that we need to pass on public safety in Illinois. These are the solutions. And then we can have a real conversation. Otherwise, it's very much just a culture war thing. There's legitimate stuff in it was called the Safety Act, the really big criminal justice system overhaul that was passed in 2021, like the elimination of cash bail, which people on the left can really be in favor of because it's unfair. You shouldn't have to be held in jail just because you can't pay. But then people on the right have a very legitimate argument of, if you don't have a system of risk assessment in place, what do you do? Like, there, you can't just get rid of something and not replace it with something that works. So that would be great if, and maybe Urban injects this into the campaign, or Sullivan or Bailey, some real solutions on the public safety side, John.
I urge people to go back and read Paul Vallis's piece. And it struck me that I don't know enough about how policing works. For instance, he was talking about redeployment of resources and so on. And Vallis does have quite a bit of experience in those areas as a former budget director for the city and also the head of the CPS. But it struck me that most of the things that he was suggested sound like they were going to cost a lot of money. Like, we're going to have to hire 1,000 people here and put these things in place. And that's another discussion to have. Okay, we know that solving the crime problem is going to require some investments and maybe higher taxes, more government spending, or redeployed spending. Where's that money going to come from? It's very easy to say, well, we need 1,000 more police officers, but who pays for them? That kind of thing. So it's going to be really interesting. But it seems just dead sure to me that Vallis is going to be running, and Duncan's going to be running, and Lightfoot's going to have some real battles on our hands next year.
I think what's resonating with people right now is they know nobody can solve the crime problem. You know what they want? Punish the crime problem. They just want to see some consequences. And that's what's really agitating people. They don't think the judges are hard enough. Obviously, they aren't happy with how Cook County State's Attorney's Office is handling these things. They just want to see some punishment. Even if that doesn't help, at least punish these people. And they don't feel that that's even happening.
Well, that just said, I mean, there are certainly obviously cases where you have to have punishment. I'm not trying to say there isn't, but as we've talked about, you can't have this pendulum swing so far to the other side that you ruin another generation's chance of trying to find some sort of solution, long-term solution to these sorts of problems.
Yes, you can.
But it's really hard to look on the 30-year trend, right? We want to look 1 year at a time, one month at a time. If you're scared, vote for the other person.
What's the 30-year trend you're talking about, John?
Well, anything. I mean, we talk about recidivism within people coming out of the jail system and going right back into it because they were put away on a marijuana charge that now is legal in the state of Illinois. Okay, we've tried to start fixing some of those things. Let's say we put a shoplifter who steals, I don't know, a pack of gum.
Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about going to the Burberry store at Oak Brook, smash the store to smithereens, and just walk out in the middle of the day with your buddies. That's
right.
What we're talking about.
Okay, but there's no black or white, right? They're all gray areas, and you've got to make determinations about what is too serious.
Okay, but in that area, the smash and grabs and the carjackings.
Okay, how long do you go to jail for smashing a Burberry store?
Well,
no one gets hurt.
For these things that we're talking about right now?
What would you put some away for?
Year and a half.
Okay.
By the way, I'm channeling my listeners in this scene. But I don't even
year
think
and
a year
half is and pretty moderate.
I was just going to say, Your Honor, I want to change my mind. I don't know if I get to do this. 5 years. I mean, people are angry, John. You can appreciate that, right?
100%. And I guess what I, and this is the horrible thing about this, is if I come on this podcast in 3 weeks because I just got carjacked, I'm going to feel a lot different about this than I do right now.
Yeah,
or if I was there and witnessed something. I am part of the not more scared than I ever have been living in Chicago camp. And there's a lot of people that are because they've experienced and they have more of a right than I do to share their opinions on it. So that's why I try and stay quiet. I don't have a solution. I know crime is cyclical in many ways, but how do I go up there having had nothing happen to me and say, chill out, everybody?
Why do you guys like this Chicago Sun-Times WBEZ merger story so much? Eric, you felt we should spend time on that. We have talked about it on this podcast before. What's the news on that front?
Well, the news on it is that the WBEZ board voted Tuesday night to go through with the deal, and they are going to, we talk about it as a merger, but essentially it's Chicago Public Media, which is WBEZ, is acquiring the Sun-Times. So, and they're going to keep the newsrooms separate, but they're going to be sharing content across the membrane that is the division between the two of them. The CEO of the Sun-Times is going to be reporting to the head of WBEZ, and it has the potential to be one of the biggest newsrooms. First of all, it's going to be the biggest newsroom in town by quite a bit once this happens. There's going to be a lot of duplicative beats and so on that they're going to have to work that all out. But it could be an amazing newsroom and a great thing for journalism in Chicago. It could also be, as somebody put it in Rob Feeder's comment area today, it could be that this is an anchor around WBEZ that so the Sun-Times has needed propping up for a long time. I think the Sun-Times is a good paper, but it's like all print journalism, it's having a hard time. So could this be that this institution is going to be relying on a lot of philanthropic support, a lot of not-for-profit sort of support in order to be sustained? But basically, I choose to be really optimistic about this, that it's going to be good for the citizens of Chicago to have such a strong combined newsroom like that, or combined effort like that.
It's kind of innovative thinking. We've all been saying, what do we do to keep journalism as vibrant as it can be in this city? And if people don't want to consume it as much as they have in the past by the traditional means, this is, I like the linking of these two. Do you, John?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I work for a nonprofit for Block Club Chicago, and that's changed everything. I mean, I have never felt, whether it was DNA Info beforehand, which was for profit, but now Block Club Chicago, which is nonprofit, I've never felt like I've worked for a stronger news organization ever. And it just changes. I don't know how to put this in eloquent words, but it changes the entire outlook and the operation, knowing that there isn't this quote unquote noose around our necks, or there could be a potential that, hey, if you don't get this many views, if you don't get this, if you don't get that. And I think that WBEZ for a long time has not only done great stuff on the radio, but their website is fantastic. Their news operation, they break news. A lot of radio stations follow the news. A lot of TV stations follow the news that is broken by the newspapers or the blogs. BEZ has always broken news. So I think this is a strong arrangement, although, yeah, there are some potential pitfalls, but it'll be interesting to see how they iron it out.
One pitfall I thought was interesting, Eric, I think you tweeted this. They maybe won't be able to endorse any political candidates anymore if they're receiving public funding. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the way the Salt Lake Tribune, which is the first big paper to go not-for-profit status, got rid of its editorial endorsements of candidates. And that doesn't mean that they can't write columns very critical of Pritzker or Irvin or any candidate out there. It just means that they can't. There's some line they cross when they urge you to go vote for a certain candidate.
It's an in-kind donation,
or something like. I mean, you know, people are talking about this, and I think that it's not the end of the world if they can't openly make a binary choice, say between a Democrat and a Republican, as long as they continue to be free to express their opinions and to have commentary and analysis. You could write editorials. I mean, certainly I wrote a lot of columns critical of Bruce Rauner, and I was never allowed in the last election to write a thing saying, I'm voting for J.B. Pritzker. Here's why you should vote for J.B. Pritzker. Anybody who read my columns in the lead up to that election would realize that I thought Rauner had been kind of a disaster and that I was hopeful about Pritzker, but I never actually had to. I was not even allowed to come out and say that. So
do endorsements matter? Does anyone care what a paper says?
I think they do certainly for down ballot races, for water commissioner.
That's how I pick judges.
Okay. And judges. Yeah.
I think ballot initiatives also, they're really helpful, especially. So like on progressive tax, every paper in the state, except the Southern, I think, Southern Illinois, came out for. So like when the preponderance of papers are one way on an issue, and I think they also have more space to kind of explain what it is. And it's like you guys said, low information races. I think they can matter, but no, I agree on governor. It's tough to say that they make a big difference.
I will say, I think that the Sun-Times coming out fairly early for Lori Lightfoot in 2019, they endorsed her candidacy. And that, I think that raised her profile. And that was a, remember, there was a huge field of candidates. Yeah. I think there were 14 or something like that. And to have the Sun-Times kind of go down into the polls and say, this woman here, this is the person you should elect for mayor, I think probably elevated her funding and certainly elevated her public profile. And I think, I mean, you could argue that that was a decisive endorsement. I think that's very rare. I think it's very rare to point to a race like that.
Maybe it's good they can't do endorsements anymore.
Well, Neil Steinberg said today that it's probably a blessing because for the staff of a newspaper to interview every candidate about everything and then pick one is so labor intensive. I want the Tribune to still do it, though. I want somebody to just give me some guidance if I agree or disagree.
You convinced me.
I know.
I'm convinced. No, really. No, well, you guys did.
But you're such a high information guy, John. I mean,
judges, you're absolutely right. And I think I read I forget who it was, put out here's what we recommend. And it's an organization that I follow that I can't remember the name of. You're better right. I did go along with that. So
one of the bar associations, I always print out who I say I should vote for judge. Because every now and then there's somebody go, this guy's a complete lunkhead. He should not be on the bench. And that's always helpful to know. They always still win. But at least it's nice to at least feel like you did your tiny little part. One last thing. So you guys are playing Wordle, which is the national rage right now, right?
Yep.
Yep. I'll play.
I love it.
Austin, you're on
it. I start every morning with it.
I'm on it, but I don't share because I feel judged when I share.
Because you don't have a good enough score.
No, my score is great, and I don't want other people to feel bad.
How considerate of you.
It's about maintaining other people's self-esteem. Austin is very selfless in that way. Yeah.
I only share if I get it in three or less.
Well, it seems to me like if you get it in one, that's cheating. If you get it in two, that's about cheating. Three is really all you can hope for. Has anybody gotten the Wordle word game in two guesses? Austin, have you done it in two?
No.
Mr. Newspaper Man, Eric, have you?
I never have. I've done three like maybe once, and I'm usually four or five. I've done some sixes too, I admit. I think it's a great puzzle. When I first started playing it, I thought it was like all luck, or a lot of it was luck. I think that's not true. I think it's a very challenging, because you can't just enter letters into this grid. Now, people who don't know what we're talking about are really bored by now, but you have to think of five-letter words, and you want to use the words, you want to use the letters that are going to fit the letters that you've already sussed out. And that's often very challenging.
It's a terrible explanation of the game, by the way.
I know. I was really talking to everybody who knows the game already. But
I think the Mincing Rascals audience is all over Wordle, okay?
Yeah.
It's like Mastermind. Did you ever play Mastermind as a kid?
Or Words with Friends or whatever that was. That was quite the rage for a while where people were. I don't know that it's like that game, but I'm trying to remember the last time something was so viral, so hot, everybody was talking about it and playing it.
And Pokemon Go. That was a sensation.
But the thing is, the great thing about Wordle is that it takes, what, about 5 minutes to play it?
Yes.
And you can only play it once.
That's the best thing about it, because you go, oh, I want to do it. It's the way some TV shows still should be released, one episode a week instead of dropping the whole series. Now you have all day to think about it and talk about it, and then you got to wait until the next day to play it again. I don't think we're going to burn out on it as fast as we would have otherwise. So we'll see how it goes. But
do you pick a random word to start, or do you pick one that has the different vowels in it to try and?
I go consonant heavy. So like I used tramp the other day because I think the vowels are easy to insert.
Okay.
So I always try and find one with one vowel in the first word, see if I get somewhere. To me, the vowels are easier to place than the remaining 21 consonants. But I'm not sure.
I'm
going to
be playing with my son and his girlfriend, and we're going to agree to start with the same word, because if you start with like adieu or something, you know,
right.
Or
that's
a lot
the
of
one
con-
you're supposed,
you know,
to do.
It seems to me like that's kind of cheating. It'd be more fun to start. So let's all pick. Let's just pick one word, and all of us will try to go from there and see how it goes.
Well, send us an invite to that little idea, Eric.
Let us know
tomorrow.
I'll do it. We'll try the same word.
Mince.
There we go. Tomorrow's puzzle.
M-I-N-C-E. I like that. There's an I and an E in there. And
we'll start with mince tomorrow, and we'll see how it goes.
We'll report back on our next podcast, too.
Excellent.
Which will, starting, let's see, not this Saturday night, but the Saturday night after that, be broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. That wraps up this Mincing Rascal. I bid you all a fond adieu. John Hansen, Austin Berg, Eric Zorn were produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, boys, good job.
Mince it is.
Yeah, mince, and we'll see how it goes.
There you go.
All right, campers. Bye now.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.